A lawsuit filed against a timber company for a pesticide spraying in Gold Beach certainly raised the visibility of the issue of pesticide use on forest land, but that's an issue people who live near industrial forest land deal with on a regular basis. The forest owners insist the pesticides are necessary to control noxious weeds and bugs that damage or compete with their growing trees. Residents nearby often wonder, and wonder aloud, whether there is a better way. This is a subject thoroughly researched by Eugene-based Beyond Toxics. The organization sponsors meetings to talk about the subject, including one coming up later this week on the northern Oregon coast. We'll detail that as we go through the program. Lisa Arkin is the executive director at Beyond Topics and our guest once again on the Jefferson Exchange. Hi, Lisa.
Good morning, Jeffrey.
It's good to have you back.
Thank you.
For the people who have not heard of Beyond Toxics, can you give us the sketch?
Sure. Beyond Toxics is a statewide environmental health and environmental justice nonprofit organization. We do a lot of grassroots work in communities that are being beset by toxic contamination. We go out to rural communities throughout the state. We do urban organizing as well, and we pay a lot of attention to how your health is being impacted by air or water quality problems.
So it is not just a strictly rural and forestry kind of thing, as you point out, because I know you've also done some work in some of the lower income areas of Eugene, where, in fact, there are lots of places that spew some stuff into the air.
That's right. And we were the group that worked on field burning in the Willamette Valley and the two laws that reduced pesticides significantly in our state at all public schools, K-12, and community colleges, and all state agencies. We also played the big role in banning neonicotinoids in the city of Eugene to help protect our bees.
So what do we know about the pesticides used in forestry in Oregon and amounts that might be used?
Ah, well, you know, that kind of gets right to the heart of the problem, is that it's rather secretive and difficult to gather information. We did a very substantial report about the logging practices and the amounts of chemicals used in one tiny place in Lane County around the Triangle Lake area. But the only reason we were able to do such a in-depth report was because the U.S. EPA had requested spray records from the helicopter operators and pesticide applicators, and once they were in the hands of the federal government, they were public documents. But other than that, the state of Oregon keeps this stuff secretive. And that's a problem, and that's one reason why people throughout the state, but especially in western Oregon, west of the Cascades, are very concerned, because there's a lot of chemical being sprayed, and there's pretty much a gag on getting information about it.
Is that because it is used as industrial practice on private property, that kind of thing?
Well, somewhat. The real reason is that the Oregon Forest Practices Act shields helicopter operators and timber owners from having to release this information, and Oregon is unique, unfortunately unique in that regard. Other states do allow the public to access this information, especially doctors or any kind of medical professionals that need to treat people who have had a pesticide poisoning. And in Oregon, that is not the case. That it's similar to ag gag laws, you know, those laws where you're not allowed to disclose.
You can't do an expose at somebody's farm, for example.
Yeah, you know, you can't let them know they're kicking chickens or, you know, shipping hogs in an inhumane way. Well, I kind of feel this is like a tree spree version of the ag gag law, where the public is prohibited from exercising their right to know about what's in their air and water.
Was the information, Lisa, public at one time? Because I know that from having worked in Oregon for nearly 30 years now, that there were times when things like timber severance taxes were matters of public record. The timber industry didn't like that because it indicated how fast they were cutting trees, and so that became unpublic information. Did a similar sort of thing happen to spray records, or was that always behind closed doors?
Well, back in, I think it was 2007, 2008, Oregon had what was called the Pesticide Use Reporting Law, which gathered information at a very high level. So you could see what was being used in different types of pesticide applications, whether it was for termite control or forestry or agriculture, at a high watershed level. So it was some data, not a lot that researchers could use, but then the legislature defunded that program, and so now we don't really have any way to get this information. You know, what's really worrying people on the in the coastal areas where so much of this stuff is sprayed is that even when they are going to an emergency room coughing up blood or vomiting after a pesticide exposure, not even their doctors are able to get this information. It's called business proprietary information, but that's really quite ridiculous.
But there have been medical requests. Somebody has attempted that pathway, it sounds like.
Yes, mm-hmm. And that was the case in Cedar Valley in Curry County, where over 40 people were impacted by a pesticide spray. They presented themselves to emergency rooms and doctor's offices, and it took almost 6 months to get the information.
This is the Gold Beach area spraying we talked
right.
about
yeah,
at the top.
Cedar yeah. Valley is mm-hmm. just the rural area mm-hmm. north east of Gold Beach.
And are these you cited a couple of instances there, vomiting and coughing up blood. These are specific instances that came out of that Cedar Valley
yes.
case?
Yes. There was the fire chief himself went to the hospital a couple of times coughing up blood. He said there was so much blood it was running pink in his shower down his chest. And he was outside when the spray was occurring, working in his yard, as were other people who were impacted. And that was his response to it. Other people felt nauseous and had intense stomach cramps. Other people developed asthma-like symptoms and couldn't breathe and missed work. An 8-month-old infant was vomiting all night. Other people had such severe respiratory ailments that, you know, either they couldn't breathe or they were just sneezing and coughing with throat constriction. Very scary symptoms.
Absolutely. I want to hear more about these, and we'll figure out what's going on that Beyond Toxics is doing. Coming up January 15th, that's later this week, in, it looks like, at the Newport High School Library.
That's right.
Yeah, we'll get into the details of that and get more into the details of what's going on generally with pesticide use on forest land in Oregon. With Lisa Arkin from Beyond Toxics, back with Lisa and your phone calls and emails in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. We're talking today about forestry and pesticides, and more specifically, their use in Oregon. Lisa Arkin is our guest on the Exchange. She's the executive director of Eugene-based Beyond Toxics, which works with communities to limit the exposure to pesticides, looks for alternatives to them, and is greatly concerned about what goes on in forestry with pesticides because very little can be known under Oregon law. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 anywhere in our listening area, 800-838-3760. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So in the Cedar Valley case you were citing, which was that October of 2013?
That was when it was sprayed, October 16th. 2013.
Okay. Yeah. And is anybody still sick? Anybody still complaining about after effects of what they think came from that spraying?
Yes. And in fact, Beyond Toxics is planning to go back to the community soon and do a follow-up health survey. We did one soon after the spray, and we'd like to do a year later look. But people are still complaining of blurry vision, loss of eyesight, a susceptibility to asthma attacks and other respiratory system, a lot of vertigo, and nosebleeds. I knew that, yeah, lots and lots of nosebleeds where people never had them before. And in fact, that was one of the most common symptoms reported at the time, was ferocious nosebleeds.
And there is a lawsuit filed over this case, correct?
Well, there was a lawsuit filed only to have the right to go to court. Mm-hmm. It's kind of complicated. It was a constitutional lawsuit, so not a lawsuit for damages or, you know, harm in any way. But under the Oregon Forest Practices Act, pesticide applicators are shielded from any kind of lawsuits. They have sort of a immunity for their actions, which makes it very difficult for your average low-income rural person to take a big logging company to court over damages. So this lawsuit, which was joined by 17 plaintiffs from the Cedar Valley region, merely asked the judge to allow them to go to court without being liable for the attorney fees of the big logging corporations.
Something like a space holder lawsuit, then, to reserve the right to sue later on?
Just to have the right under the Oregon Constitution to have your day in court. The Oregon Constitution says that everyone has a right to seek redress. They may not win, but they have the right to seek it. But under the Oregon Forest Practices Act, that right is severely limited. Plus, if you go to court, let's say you're the fire chief of Curry in Cedar Valley, Curry County, not a very lucrative position, and you want to say, you know, my property was damaged or my health was damaged, you would probably have to pay the fees of 10 corporate lawyers who they hired to take you down in court. It's a chilling effect, essentially, because very few people are willing to take that chance. And so this lawsuit merely asked if people could go to court without having to come up with the money to pay corporate lawyers.
And I want to make it clear, too, because in the material I've read about this, we're not talking about, if you'll forgive the broad generalization, a bunch of dreadlock-wearing hippies who just hate the timber industry. Some of these people really do support the timber industry, just not what happened here.
Right. They were loggers, construction workers, auto mechanics, fishermen. These are people who are the salt of the community, or, you know, the bedrock, I guess, the bedrock of the community. And they love living in rural Oregon, and never did they think that just because they lived near trees, they would be assaulted in this way.
Now, you mentioned that, Lisa, that coastal areas are seem to be a little more concerned than some others. Why? Is this just because this is where there's more spraying going on?
This is where there's more logging going on, because trees in the western part of Oregon are the fir trees that are merchantable timber. And so with the climate on the coast, which is temperate and kind of a temperate rainforest climate, trees grow faster. They can grow closer together. And so this is where these monoculture tree farms have been established. So as tree rotations increase over time, it used to be that trees were allowed to grow 60, sometimes 70 years, and you had these beautiful big trees to log and make timber. Now rotations are between 30 and 40 years commonly. And so in order to get those trees to grow as fast as possible, they use a lot of chemical to do that. Whereas before, when the rotations were longer, not so much chemical was used.
But again, we can't really know.
Well, just the trends that we saw in the Triangle Lake area was a significant increase in the pounds per acre spray just over 3 years. And we don't really know why, but what we found that we didn't know before was these companies use tank mixes of multiple chemicals, sometimes 3 to 4 active ingredients, plus a petroleum carrier like crop oil, plus 1 or 2 more what are called adjuvants. These increase the potency of the active ingredient. And I had one doctor contact me quite concerned that they were spraying a petroleum product, because basically then people who are exposed to the drift are breathing vaporized petroleum oil, which causes all sorts of serious problems for the lungs.
And so, interesting. So, I mean, to your knowledge, it seems like the laws that direct the use of these things, if not the reporting of them, would specify things like whether or not these soups can be made.
Not true. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, you'd think it would be, but no, there's no regulation, not on the label, nor in the state of Oregon, that govern how these chemicals can be mixed. So this is mixed pretty much on site. So the person in charge of the spray operation will haul tank loads of chemicals to the landing site, where they'll load them onto the helicopter tanks, and they mix them on site there. And the interesting thing was they used to claim that there was no way they could tell the public in advance what they were going to spray, But it takes a lot of time and effort and money to haul chemicals out to mountaintops, so they do know well in advance what they plan to use. It's no, you know, it's not a secret art where suddenly you get inspiration at a moment that tells you what to use in your tank mix. They have a consultant that's looking at the land and deciding what to use and conveying that information to the helicopter operator, who then hauls those chemicals to the site in big tanker trucks. And in fact, there was a tanker truck in Curry County that crashed on its way to a job and spilled atrazine down an embankment.
Down an embankment that ended up in a stream?
We never could really get information on that, strangely enough.
This sounds like a fairly frustrating process.
True, it is. But we have great people in these rural communities who have come together. I really take heart when I see folks from Curry County meeting up with folks from Tillamook County and sharing their stories and trying to figure out how can we make Oregon as accountable as our neighboring states in the Pacific Northwest. And this is what's most frustrating, is that in Washington, Idaho, and Alaska, the laws are much more protective of public health and drinking water quality. In Oregon, we have fallen decades behind in our use of science and our acknowledgement that these chemicals are not only harmful, but that logging can be quite lucrative without aerial spray of all this pesticide tank mix.
And what do you know about California law and how it compares to the states you mentioned?
Yeah, California law is the most strict of all, and it's so detailed that we tend not to talk about it as much because it's just very different than what's done in Washington, Idaho, and Alaska.
Strict on the people applying pesticides?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. They have very solid regulation regarding what you have to report and what you can use, and they also limit how many acres can be clear cut. So when you limit clear cutting, it also reduces the need for all this chemical herbicide and chemical fertilizer.
Lisa Arkin's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She's the executive director of Beyond Toxics, based in Eugene. Our topic today, obviously talking about spraying of pesticides on industrial forest land, which has some issues in the state of Oregon, not the least of which is the fact that there's not a lot that can be known about it, given Oregon state law. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange with questions, comments, concerns, case studies, 800-838-3760 around the region, 800-838-3760, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Lisa, while we're paused here, why don't you tell us about the event coming up this week in Newport?
Yes, the town hall in Newport is the third in a series that are being done up and down the western part of Oregon. This Thursday, on January 15th, the Newport residents there concerned about their drinking water and their health will be holding a town hall meeting called Forestry, Herbicides, and Health. There'll be a light dinner served at 5:30 for a very tiny $6 contribution, and then the panel starts at 7. There are 5 panelists, and it should be a great conversation. The whole thing is going to be moderated by Lincoln County Commissioner Bill Hall.
Have the commissioners in Lincoln County either individually or collectively taken any position on spraying?
No, not that I know of. Mm-mm.
All right. Let's take a call here. We have Julie in Ashland on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Lisa Arkin.
Hi, Jeffrey. Thank you. thank you for doing this work. I just have a quick question. It's just about wildlife in general. I'm sure it's even harder to get reports about the effect of all this on them who are directly living in these forests. So what would you say about that? Is there any opportunity to protect them?
Did you say, which animal did you mention? Sorry.
Well, the wildlife in general.
Oh, just wildlife. Generally. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that question. There isn't a lot of data, but interestingly enough, we receive phone calls quite often from hunters who call us. I love it when they say, you know, I'm a hunter and, you know, I'm hunting out in Douglas County and I don't know who to call, so I'm calling you, Beyond Toxics. I can't find anything to hunt, and what I do find is so sickly, you know, I'm not going to eat it. So we had a call from a hunter out at in the Mohawk Valley in Lane County, say he's a third-generation hunter. He was taught by his grandfather and father. He wants to teach his sons, and he says when he takes his sons out there, it's a dead land. He calls it the moonscape. There's nothing moving. And he says, my son gets bored and just wants to go back and play video games, you know. He said, the wildlife can't survive because when they clear cut, they take out all the places animals can nest or hide. And then when they spray and kill all of the native plants, like the Oregon grape or ceanothus, then there's nothing for elk and deer to eat. So they're starving, which then compromises their immune system and makes them more susceptible to other diseases.
When you'd mentioned the tanker truck that crashed in Curry County and spilled some atrazine, I know from having talked to other researchers in the past about the effects of atrazine, and they're concerned.
Yeah,
for sure. Are there measurable amounts showing up in streams from spray? I mean, because we talked about the air effect on the people affected in Cedar Valley, but there must be something that indicates you're finding greater concentrations of pesticides in streams. And I'm talking about coastal first. I do want to get to more about Triangle Lake in just a moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's also part of this, gag problem, is that there's not a lot of monitoring going on. Beyond Toxic submitted data, which was accepted by the Department of Environmental Quality. So that means our data was valid. And we did testing of salmon streams in the Triangle Lake area and did find atrazine and its metabolites. But there's really no human health standards established by our federal government. So it's hard to say this was a dangerous amount or this was not a dangerous amount by governmental standards. However, because atrazine in particular is an endocrine disruptor, meaning that in infinitesimally small amounts, it can make changes in one's hormone system. We don't think there would be any safe level, especially for a child. Atrazine is also well established to create reproductive havoc in amphibians.
It changes sexes in frogs, doesn't it?
It's absolutely 180-degree change in sexes. It causes a biologically male frog to grow ovaries and produce eggs at the same time it's also producing testes and to mate with other male frogs. So that's not a great way to maintain a frog population because you're not going to get little polywogs out of that.
Right. Let's take another call. We have Paul in Grants Pass on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Lisa Arkin from Beyond Toxics.
Good morning, Lisa. Keep fighting the good fight.
Thank you, Paul.
We had a guest on this program a while back by the name, I believe, of Edward Valienteros. I apologize if I massacred his name. And he wrote a book, I believe, called Poison Spring that talked about... Are you familiar with that?
That's right. I'm holding it in my hands right here.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, I'm coming in late into the conversation, but anything that happens is going to happen at the local level because the state and federal levels of government in terms of the oversight, particularly at the federal level, are so horribly corrupt that there is no way that we can ever stop poisoning ourselves and poisoning our land. It's going to have to be local action.
Thank you. I think I have to agree, and that's really the only way we have hope, is knowing that each community in Oregon can stand up and say, why should Oregon be the lowest common denominator of all the Northwest states in this area of logging regulation and chemical regulation? And you're right, we have to do this at the local level, and we have to shine a light on it.
How much response do you get from members of the legislature about changing laws that would at least allow people to know a bit more about exactly what gets used, how often, how much, and all those things?
So glad you asked that question, Jeffrey, because there are legislators who have taken note of what's happened in Curry County, Lane County, Lincoln County, Douglas County, Tillamook County. I mean, this poisoning in Curry County might have been the most egregious, but it's not the only one. And so we do have legislation being introduced in the 2015 Oregon legislature that would get at the problem of the secrecy. So it would require the Oregon Department of Forestry to post this information on a publicly accessible website. It would require that people be able to get spray records, especially for medical problems. And it would require the same kinds of buffer zones as in Washington and Idaho.
I have to believe that, again, there are guidelines for use. I mean, are there specifications for you can use only up to this level of stuff? I mean, and therefore, ultimately, there should be some ability, even if it is records the public never sees, to confirm whether or not the things are being used correctly.
Each pesticide has a label, and in the vernacular, it's called the label is the law. So you have to follow what's on the label of the product, which often is in teeny tiny print. So I hope those spray operators have their magnifying glass with them out there on site. It does give guidelines as to how many ounces or how many pounds per acre. But in the case of the Curry County spray, the helicopter operator was found to have violated that. He had applied too much or more than the label allowed. And no one would have known that had the people in Cedar Valley, along with help from Beyond Toxics, not demanded to have a thorough investigation. They filed petitions, and the fact that they tried to document their illnesses and the harm to their pets and livestock, all this was a sort of combined to force the agencies to do a very thorough investigation. That's how that was found out.
Much more to talk about when we're talking about forestry and pesticides. Lisa Arkin from Beyond Toxics, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with her. You can join the conversation when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about the use of pesticides in forestry from the questioning side, the side presented by Beyond Toxics, which is based in Eugene. Lisa Arkin is the executive director of the group and our guest here on the Exchange. You can join our conversation as we talk about the use of pesticides, the fact that the way in which pesticides are used on forest land in Oregon is very hard to know given state law and the lack of transparency there. Phone numbers here at the Exchange. Phone number 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Beyond Toxics did put together a report. It looks like was it December of 2013, Oregon's Industrial Forests and Herbicide Use?
That's right. Yes, it's available on our website.
And was that primarily about the coast and Triangle Lake, just Triangle Lake?
It was just about Triangle Lake because, as we mentioned in the beginning, when you asked how do we get a hold of these records, we could only get 3 years' worth of records because of the U.S. EPA investigation. So in Oregon, under law, only the state forester can request that these spray records be turned over to an agency. And before Triangle Lake, he had never, ever requested that spray records be made available for researchers or scientists or the public. So this was a really a watershed report in that way because we were able to get access to 3 years' worth of data and do very in-depth analysis.
Describe the area, if you would, Lisa, to the folks who might not know it, and give us an idea of how broad an area we're talking about and what goes on there or what had been going on there.
Sure. In Triangle Lake, it's located in Lane County, about midway between Eugene and the coast. You go out Highway 36 to get there, sort of near the town of Mapleton. It's a beautiful area, very typical of the Oregon coast, and has this lovely little lake that's shaped like a triangle that is used for recreation. It's also a prime salmon spawning area, and in its watershed contains one of those rare cold core streams where salmon go to spawn and juveniles can live. The area that we concentrated on was only about 180,000 acres, I think, because that's all that we had. Yeah, 184,000 acres, 640 acres of sections. Mm-hmm. It's kind of difficult to say. So you have rural residents living there. You have a number of communities there. And then you have this beautiful salmon spawning area, plus a recreational area. There are parks there. There are boating ramps. So both wildlife and humans coming together in just a gorgeous little spot.
And so what – you must have come in here with some expectations, given the fact you had access to records, yay, for the first time.
Yeah.
So some expectations about what you would find, and how did what you saw in the records compare with your expectations?
Well, one thing we discovered is that in 2011, when the residents of Triangle Lake complained bitterly about being exposed to aerial drift and no one would listen to them, they actually had urine samples taken and analyzed by a reputable lab over at the University of Georgia and found that 100% of the 40-plus people who had urine samples taken had both atrazine and 2,4-D at significantly high amounts in their urine. So that means that they had been exposed somehow. And once we knocked out all the data, we saw a rise in the use of 2,4-D and atrazine in that same year, 2011. In fact, atrazine increased by over 70% and 2,4-D increased by over 80% from previous years. So I think that was surprising, but it helped explain why so many complaints were filed in that year. It was not their imagination, and it was, in a sense, to be expected that you would find these chemicals in their bodies.
All right. So did you go in expecting something one way or the other about the use of the pesticides themselves and volumes or weights? I'm not sure how they measure those things.
We didn't go in expecting anything because there had been so little information before then.
It was really hard to even have a baseline to start from, huh?
No, we didn't have a baseline. So it took us two years to get this report really finalized and going back over and over and over the data and all the effort we spent to use GIS mapping to map it and then look for statistical trends in the data. So we also learned something that had been suspected but that the timber industry had denied. We found that herbicides were being sprayed multiple years on the same site. And since we only had 3 years of data, we could only calculate up to 3 years, but we found that it was very common for a site to have been sprayed three times in a row. So that means more and more chemical on the land and more chemical saturating the soil and the potential for being washed into salmon streams or into drinking water.
So I'm curious about control groups with the Highway 36 Triangle Lake investigation, whether you were able to sample people not in that area or at least farther away from it for the same substances, whether there were urine tests for that would have detected 2,4-D and or atrazine from people who would have been outside that area. I guess what I'm asking for is if there is anybody else in the world who ever shows up with 2,4-D and atrazine in their urine.
Well, actually, sadly, yes, there are. Now, the sampling was not done by Beyond Toxic, so that was done by professional medical or health agencies. Now, the Oregon Health Authority did run a second test about 6 months after the first one was done and found reduced levels, but we learned that 2,4-D and atrazine are sprayed only in the springtime, which is when that first urine sample was taken. In the fall, the timber industries use a whole different set of chemicals for fall sprays. And so when the Oregon Health Authority sampled in the fall, no 2,4-D nor atrazine had been sprayed. And yet, especially 2,4-D was still turning up in people's urine, but at reduced amounts. So, yes, the US EPA and the Center for Disease Control have done national studies and have national statistics, but they often use pesticide applicators to get their data, where you'd have a lot of exposure. And you've probably read reports, Jeffrey, where they're finding all sorts of industrial chemicals in babies as they come out of the womb, you know, so they're getting exposed through their mother's blood. So no one is safe, but the amounts of chemical found in the urine of people in Triangle Lake was statistically pretty significant, especially that springtime spray.
And you have made the information certainly public. What sorts of responses do you get? I imagine you You emailed a few copies over to representatives of the timber industry. What sorts of responses, if any, did you get?
Well, the timber industry hasn't said too much because I don't think they can refute this data.
But what's the general position you often get back about defending the use of the herbicides and pesticides on forest land?
Yeah, they say that they have to use these chemicals to be economically successful in logging. But we will answer to that. It's not true because let's take a company like Weyerhaeuser, which is an international company. They're logging in Oregon, but they're also logging in Washington, for example. They have a lot of land holdings in Washington. So in Washington, they're following laws that require them to report their chemicals to the state agencies. The state agencies are monitoring their sprays. They're giving agency comments before the sprays occur. It's a whole application system rather than what Oregon has, which is not an application system. In Washington state, the public is allowed to see these documents and make public comment. There are buffer zones that are sometimes six times wider than in Oregon, but I don't see Weyerhaeuser going out of business in the state of Washington. I don't see Washington say that their timber industry is failing. So that argument is specious. It's just not true. They can do better at protecting public health and our drinking water and still be viable as an economic force in our state.
Lisa Arkin, when you talk about this as an application system, you mean in Washington state they have to apply for permission to do the spraying?
Correct, yes. And in fact, they apply, the state foresters in Washington go over the application. They actually walk the land or survey the land with the timber owner, and they determine where the streams are, where the wells are, where people might have pipes, where they get their rural drinking water, where the wetlands are. They go over it and make sure everything has been identified, mapped, and a protection plan is in place. And then the public gets to comment on it. Furthermore, the public is notified 5 days ahead of any kind of pesticide use. So there's posting all around the site saying what will be used and when. And then the posting remains up for 15 days after the spray occurs because we know that there is volatilization that happens after a spray where it kind of keeps going into the air. So people in Washington get to know 5 days in advance and be warned 15 days after. In Oregon, there's no application system. There's no agency oversight. There's no public comment. There's no prior notification. And in fact, if you want a written version of a notification, you have to pay money, $25 minimum per year, which gets you just a little bit of a notification. And these come in the mail to you, snail mail, and oftentimes they come too late. So the spray already happened by the time you get your notification in the mail.
So there's no notification requirement whatsoever.
Correct.
In Oregon.
Correct.
Huh.
California, Washington, and federal forests require public notification.
And just in terms of the post notification, I mean, if somebody does, for example, I mean, I know you talked about some of this earlier, but is there anything then at this point in Oregon law that would give medical professionals access to some information about what was sprayed if somebody comes and says, hey, I'm feeling really bad?
There's absolutely nothing. And so because of the greater public scrutiny that's on this issue now because of what happened in Curry County, there have been four hearings at the state legislature in the Senate Environment Committee on this issue. And the heads of the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Forestry did testify just in December that they would provide spray records to the public when asked. So Beyond Toxics has submitted the request for spray records on behalf of six individuals who were harmed by aerial sprays in the last 3 years. So
requested but haven't heard back yet?
We just submitted those last week.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that this testimony was given. It was given to our state legislatures. It's on websites. You can check it out yourself and look for hearings in the State Environment and Natural Resources Committee of the Senate and the House Agriculture Committee. where the heads of these agencies stated unequivocally that they will provide spray records when the public requests them.
Within any certain confines, though?
When
the public requests them in certain circumstances? Or
that wasn't clear. They just said they would provide them.
Huh. I guess we'll have to see how that gets done. You've talked about buffer zones a couple of times. I want to burrow in just a little further here. We're talking about a couple of different kinds of buffer zones. So why don't you tell me what it is that you're seeking here?
Mm-hmm. So in the state of Washington, for example, on a drinking water stream or a fish stream, there's a range of buffers depending on the size of the stream and the various geographical configurations. But anyway, you can go from approximately 100 feet buffer zone all the way up to 325, depending on, as I said, various characteristics and the weather and the height of the helicopter. In Oregon, we have a one-size-fits-all. We have 60 feet for all fish-bearing streams and drinking water streams. So 60 feet compared to approximately 100 all the way up to 325.
But how do you get, how can you be sure from a helicopter you're not going to land anything within 60 feet of a stream?
Well, you can't be sure. And Oregon Public Broadcasting, Earthfix of Oregon Public Broadcasting, just did a story last month about a situation in Tiller, which is along the Umpqua River in Douglas County.
Southern Douglas County, yeah.
I don't know if you read that one, but they found the herbicide on the other side of the river, and they admitted that the spray was done according to Oregon's regulations.
Hmm.
So then everyone was scratching their head. Well, how did that spray drift happen if this was according to regulation? I think the reporter there, excellent report by Tony Schick, raises the question, well, then are our regulations adequate enough to protect rivers?
And your answer is generally no.
No, not compared to other states. Oregon lags far behind. Even Idaho gives you a minimum of 100 feet. And again, we have only 60 feet.
Mm-hmm.
In Washington and Idaho, they protect all running surface water. So if you have a small tributary to a drinking water stream, that's protected, but not in Oregon. We have a zero buffer. That means you can spray right over the river.
We have learned a lot today. The legislature is probably going to learn a great deal in this year's legislative session as well from Beyond Toxics, where Lisa Arkin is the executive director. Lisa, thanks for joining us once again on The Exchange.
It was my pleasure, Jeffrey. Thank you for covering this issue.
You bet. Take care.